Commander Rappard, Rail 15. We were talking about when you joined HMS Byron at Sheerness, so just discussing, round about January 1944.
January, February 1944.
And you were discussing the watches, that there's irregularities about it.
Well, I was, as first tenant, I was the head of the Seamen's Department as well as second command of the ship. The chief rating in that department was the chief person mate. And like some of the other people on board, he had been retired for a while. And his last active job, I think, had been as chief person's mate of the Royal Yacht. Well, that was the sort of job where all the seamen and the officers were carefully chosen so that everything ran like clockwork. And the really important thing there was to get the paintwork right and the brass polished and so on. He was therefore somewhat out of his depth, dealing with people who were in the Navy for hostilities only and hadn't had full training. And many of the leading seamen and petty officers were not very experienced. So instead of applying the rules and tightening it up, he just accepted this situation and let it run. And I found that when both watches of the hands fell in, both watches of the hands being the sailors, the seamen, fell in, they weren't necessarily all there. Some of them were still in their bunks. Unlike previous ships, they didn't have hammocks in this one because it was made for Americans. We had bunks. And so I realized after only two or three days that there was a fairly large problem to be dealt with, because if the officers didn't know who was the duty officer, and not all the sailors were turning up when they were required to turn up for work, and that the chief boatswain's mate, who was my senior rating, didn't make them turn up, and the coxswain had been attacked by the Liberty men coming back on board, something needed tightening up rather badly. Then I discovered, to my horror, that we were going to be inspected by Captain D down at Sheerness only about 3 weeks later. The ship was employed on East Coast convoys. So we did a couple of trips of that. Meanwhile, I was beginning to get the measure of who actually had turned up to work and where the others were and who was responsible. So I brought my officers together, said how unhappy I was about the seaman end of it, and I took the advice of two older officers. One was an ex-gunner, who was a warrant officer, who'd been retired also for some time. And I said, what did he think? And he said, well, he'd never been in a ship like this before. He supposed they were all like that in the war, but it was the only one he'd been in. And the engineer officer, who'd run a power station in the northwest of England before coming to sea as an RNR officer, who also kept the books for the wardroom mess books. And he said it was very odd, but his engines were all right, and he could rely on doing that, and he didn't interfere with other people's departments. He was a sort of trade union approach to it. So I thought, did some very hard thinking in my cabin as to what on earth one should try and do, and I could see absolutely no alternative but to get very strict indeed and to make it quite clear what standards were wanted. But I also knew that in some ships like that, which were subsequently described as hell ships, officers had been known to disappear over the side of the ship in the dark at sea. I didn't want that to happen either. So I thought I'd better start in the wardroom, and I made certain that the officers did know when they were on duty and what their duties were. And I got hold of the first tenant's standing orders, which were, in my view, somewhat inadequate, and rewrote them. And I think there's a copy of those still around somewhere now. I've no idea how different they were to other people's first tenant's standing orders, because I had to take what was available and get on with it. I also found that I had to disrate two of the petty officers in the seaman outfit because they were not doing what they said they were doing. They were reporting their people ready for work without actually having got them out of bed. I took the old chief person mate on one side and told him that, as a very experienced chief petty officer, I was relying on him implicitly to back me up in doing what I was doing, and explained to him in words of one syllable what it was. But he was actually more concerned to make lovely pricks of tobacco for people and things he'd done in the Royal Yacht, and make sure the paint was right. He was a bit of a busted flush. I also got the engineer officer, to go through the wardroom books with me, because I wanted to know whether the wardroom, as I was president of the wardroom mess, and the captain wasn't a member of the mess, he had his own messing, but he usually ate with us. I wanted to find out what the money state was, and to my horror, I found the chief said we were in funds, we were making a profit, but that part of that profit was the fact that the captain had never paid a mess bill since he'd been at the ship, and so money owed by the captain was shown as being an asset, and this was where the profit came from. And I knew that that wouldn't be acceptable to anybody who audited these accounts, and so I went to see the captain privately and said I thought there might have been a bit of an oversight, and I'd be grateful, you know, could he please, and he said, oh, have a drink, number one. No, I've got a bit of a problem. And it turned out his problem was that all his money went to his wife and he hadn't got any. And that he couldn't pay, he told me. So I was in the extraordinary position of the captain telling the second in command that he couldn't pay his mess bill. And an inspection coming up very soon afterwards. So I said, well, look, I will pay off your mess bill, but I would like you to make out an allotment from your pay officially so that I'll get the money back over, shall we say, 3 months or 6 months. Oh, would you, he said. Astonishingly, that's what we did. And so the whole of the wardroom accounts were rewritten from scratch by the engineer officer on my instructions. And we got away with it when the captain's secretary actually inspected the books. Nobody was aware on the ship, officially anyway, that the captain was paying me to pay for his mess bill, which was unusual, to say the least of it. There was a certain amount of resentment in my tightening up process, and we did go and practice at a working up place, but not for a few months. By then, we'd just about got the ship ticking.
What was Southcombe?
KGL Southcombe.
What was he like as a bloke?
Charming. Easy. A delightful man. Used to live on the bridge at sea. He had a sort of deck chair on the bridge, and he used to sleep in it, because he liked to be able to hear the ping of the Asdic set going on. And if something happened, he would be woken up by the change of echo or the noises made. And he wanted to be able to react quickly to fighting his ship, which, looked at through the other end of the telescope, meant that he wasn't actually trusting his officers to get on with it. But I wasn't going to argue with that one.
Well, I mean, was he a competent officer?
I have no reason to think that he wasn't competent in steering the ship, driving it, and all that sort of thing. But as far as making certain that his officers were competent, no, I don't think he was. So because I took over at a moment when quite clearly things had not gone right, partly because the first lieutenant appointed originally was too seasick to do the job and had to leave, so they were one short. And they did lack experience.
I mean, was there any origin in it? I mean, did he have a drink problem or something like that?
No, not that I know of. No, I don't think he did.
So it wasn't excessive drinking that had built up this bill. It was just a natural bill.
It was a natural bill. Oh, the bill was not abnormal. Indeed, I did privately check what his wine bill was in the middle of all this and found nothing to worry about, because that was the way my mind went originally too. But there was nothing to account for it except that his wife cost more than other people's wives, I think. Never met her, in fact.
The tightening up process, how did the different levels of the crew, I mean your officers, how did they respond? How did
I think the officers, my seaman officers, were somewhat worried initially, because I was a new broom and I had to sweep around a great deal. And I had to get them together to do it publicly to all of them, but made a great point of dealing with each one individually. And when I met two of them again the other day at a reunion, they were aware that this process had been going on. One of them, who was a midshipman and clearly hadn't been taught anything much by the time I first got to know him, now a sort of late middle-aged gentleman doing his thing, had reacted to the fact that at least he knew what was happening. One of the lieutenants, a chap called Buck Taylor, he was prepared to do what he was told and to make the best of it, and he was felt responsible for what he was doing, and in fact did a sound job, and I could rely on him. But I knew that one or two of the sailors whom I'd had to disrate, or indeed punish, were not too keen, and I could understand that too.
Did this cause problems? I mean, did ship's morale then improve after the tightening?
Very definitely. It became what I think was an efficient ship, and it was a happy ship too. I was talking only a couple of weeks ago to a man who was a leading seaman on board, in my outfit therefore, who was coxswain of the whaler when we put it down as a seaboat one day and somewhere up in Icelandic waters, where it's a story I'll tell later. But a couple of weeks ago he was almost embarrassingly supportive as to what I'd done. And I had particular contact with a man called Able Seaman McIver, who had been apparently the first lieutenant's servant there, nominated as such before I got there. And he was a staunch Norwegian fisherman, was a very silent man, much older than I was. I have to remember that we're talking about 1944, and I wasn't yet 23 when I was second in command of the ship, and this chap was very nearly old enough to be my father. And he supported me absolutely up to the hilt, and it was a great feeling to have an older man, even though he happened to be an able seaman and I was a lieutenant, supportive in what he knew was going on. We didn't discuss what the sailors were thinking about it, but I got a very good feeling. I knew a great deal about sailors and their reactions by then, because I'd been very close to them for the previous 3 or 4 years. And I think I got the feel that I was stretching the elastic a bit tight, but it wasn't going to break. Both in the wardroom and in the ship's company.
Now, perhaps I'd like you now to tell me a bit about the ship, the Byron, because it was almost completely different from the Tartar in almost every way you can imagine, while still being a destroyer or frigate, as they were technically. But I mean, could you describe the ship, and perhaps concentrating on what was different?
Well, the basics, first of all, the ship construction was entirely different to anything I'd been in. It was a welded ship, not riveted. Therefore, it was rigid. It didn't flex at all on the sea. It had tiny little pop guns, 3-inch guns.
Hang on. Now, the welded thing, did that bother you? Because some officers who'd been in other ships were bothered that it wasn't riveted. They said it would break up and sink, that sort of...
I didn't hear this myself for a while. But when we were later based, after the invasion, we were based in Belfast in Northern Ireland, those ships which had been torpedoed and bits of them were brought back had in fact snapped in two. So we had three of our destroyer escorts berthed not terribly far away from us, where we knew some of the people in them had been killed. They were left within sight of us, which I thought was not frightfully good management of morale. But they had undoubtedly snapped, whereas the riveted ones bent a bit. It could be the riveted ones would then sink because they would be dragged down by the other part. There was several points of view, but they were different.
And other parts, before we go on to the armour, but the through deck business, they look different from British destroyers. They don't have the step or...
Yes, they were not destroyers as such. They were essentially something less than that in our Navy. I believe the technical distinction was having to do with the guns, the size of the guns, and torpedoes particularly. We carried no torpedoes. The Americans put in much heavier armament into the same hulls and did include torpedoes. It was therefore apparent very quickly that the ship constructors, in the British ship constructors, were very worried indeed about the stability of these ships. And they had refused to have them with the bigger guns and the torpedoes because they reckoned they would be too much top weight. I think they had probably overcorrected because we had 3-inch guns and no torpedoes, therefore so little top weight that you had an incredibly stiff roll. I think we went rolled about 40 degrees either side of the vertical in something like 6.5 seconds, sort of over and back again. So the accelerations were alarming, and I wasn't at all surprised to find my predecessor had been too sick to stay on her. I was sick as a cat, too, but not quite as sick as he had been. Obviously, I didn't get unconscious with it. We gradually were making our point about this, about them not being really very seaworthy in the sense of being having a ship's company able to work them at these astonishing speeds of roll. And so the constructors agreed that we could weld railway lines on the upper deck to add to the top weight. We also brought up much more of the ready-use ammunition and stowed it up top and had more Oerlikon ammunition in lockers on the upper deck as well. And indeed, we stowed more depth charges on the upper deck rather than down below. And this gave us an extra, I don't know, about a second, I think, of between the extremes of the roll and back again. But their lordships and their wisdom then provided half hard lying money for those who served in these ships during the winter in the North Atlantic, which was a nice argument because it was tuppence halfpenny or something. I don't know the exact sum, but it was small. But it was astonishing in one sense that one was receiving hard lying money for me lying in a vice-spring mattress with hot and cold running water in my cabin, for example.
Well, let's look at the facilities. What was your cabin like? Could you describe it as first?
It was very close to the wardroom, just the first cabin, far out of the wardroom, on the same level, so I was nearer to the wardroom than I had been in any other ship. It was well-appointed in rather dull grey furniture, painted furniture, made of metal, all of it, no wood anywhere, whereas British ships tended to have wood and therefore no doubt burnt better. I had a carpet, which was quite extraordinary. I had never had a carpet before on a ship. I had adequate storage space for all my things. And I couldn't sleep in the bed at sea. The reason being that if we had a beam on to the sea, and she was railing, then the accelerations concerned compressed the mattress in one direction and chucked me out on the deck in the other direction. So I either had to strap myself in or sleep on the deck, and I chose to sleep on the deck in rough seas.
So you'd have preferred a hammock?
I would have been more comfortable in a hammock, but it was probably infradig for an officer to live in a hammock in a ship which was fitted with bunks for all the sailors. Because they didn't have hammocks either in the ship.
Did you have more space in your cabin than you would have expected?
No. Second in command of a destroyer or frigate usually had adequate space because he needed more paper than ordinary officers who probably shared cabins anyway.
What about the other officers?
They had smaller, fewer cubic feet, but perfectly reasonable drawer space, cupboard space, and that sort of thing, and a tiny desk.
Now, what about the wardroom? Could you give us a description of what the wardroom had and what it offered?
The wardroom was, of course, forward and therefore nearer one's action station. It was on the upper deck, and therefore it had reasonable light on both sides coming in through the portholes. It had room for 12 officers to sit down at the same time, and reasonable cooking facility somewhere. I was the wardroom cook. I was quite happy to say it did awfully well. And where it was necessary, we shared food with the ship's company. And where it wasn't, we paid extra and had a bit better food. But the cook was perfectly able to cope with that. We weren't luxuriously fitted out with stewards or anything like that. There were essentially one cook was provided, and I think one steward, and an occasional sailor who came to help when it was necessary.
Now, what about the food you got? Could you?
Food was comparable with what I'd had in the previous two ships. There was nothing good or bad one way or another.
What would you
as the president
get?
Of the wardroom mess, if I didn't like it, I got somebody to do better pretty damn quickly.
So what was it? I mean, I don't know whether you remember. The
bacon
sort
and
of
eggs and things in the morning, and of course fresh milk was a luxury we rarely had, except we were in harbour. Occasionally, when we had, because we were essentially an anti-submarine ship, we were dropping depth charges or firing hedgehog. And therefore occasionally attack shells of fish instead of submarines. And we very quickly developed a quick way of scooping them out of the water while they were still floating belly upwards. So we occasionally had marvelous fresh fish, which literally was caught that morning. That was a luxury compared to a large ship, which never had that particular thing. But they had more freezer space, of course, than large ships, the cold rooms and cool rooms. The feel of the ship was entirely different.
Hang on, I'll come on. Just sticking to a few of the...
Sticking to the food.
What about the drinking habits of the mess? I mean, what would you drink? What sort of levels were I expected? What was the usual drink of choice in the wardroom? Was it still
I don't think there was a usual. It was essentially what people wanted. In most ships, the officers took their lead on drink from the one or two older ones or senior ones in the mess. I happened to be the second in command of the ship, but I was also the second youngest officer in the wardroom, and I still didn't like gin, and I very rarely drank a glass of whiskey or anything like that. So my tipple, if I didn't have a glass of beer occasionally, was probably a glass of sherry before supper, or maybe a little wine with whatever, if we were in harbour. But I didn't drink at sea at all. And I don't think the other officers did either.
Would that, they'd be following your example there, or would the captain not drink either at sea?
Captain had his own arrangements for drink up in his cabin, and occasionally one in harbour. He would come to the wardroom, we'd have a drink. But I didn't see any drunkenness in that wardroom. Whereas in Tartar, every now and then, we were overstressed and we went over the top, and no doubt about it. In Sheffield, I honestly don't know what the wardroom drinking habits were, because I was literally only a midshipman and only allowed 5 shillings a month anyway. But I had no problem with drink among the officers at all.
Now, what about the armament of a ship? You'd been closely connected with it on the Tartar, less so perhaps on this one. Well, could you go? What about the 3-inch? Let's go through the things in starting with the much maligned 3-inch gun. What did you think of it after you? I mean, what you'd had on
my
the Tartar?
My first reaction was that there were pop guns and too few of them. I was also aware that the Americans in the same ships had bigger guns and more sophisticated control equipment. This was absolutely basic. And it was not designed in the British Navy as a ship which would be used to use its guns in a position where it would have to use its guns. If one had to fire off these things, okay, one fired them off. We had some Ehrlichans which were designed to help protect us against E-boats or against...
I'll come back. Now, these 3 inches, you said it didn't have much control. Did they have any central control capability?
Well, somebody had to point them in the right direction, but there was no super calculating equipment on board, no. We would have been very lucky. We did do some shoots at targets, and we were hugely impressed if we got anywhere near the target at all. I always felt anxious about the target towing ship rather than target itself.
And what about the penetration of the 3-inch? Because a lot of people seem to have thought that they couldn't get through anything hard.
Well, they couldn't. I mean, they were a joke. And I took the view that the main rail of the ship was anti-submarine and the main armament of the ship was its depth charges and its hedgehog.
Well, let's go to the depth charges next then. Could you describe how they were stored and how fired and the rest, the control of it all?
We could fire 10 charges in a pattern. You had two rails right aft, which sloped downwards towards the aft end of the ship, so literally these great cans of explosive rolled down. You had depth charge throwers on either side, which threw them out about 50 feet, something like that, so that you could have a pattern that way. And you also could vary the depth at which the depth charge is fired, the idea being to sandwich the submarine between explosions top and bottom. So you might have a 100-foot difference of depth set between those to explode shallower and those explode deep. The hedgehog, however, was a head-thrown weapon, was designed to explode if it hit something. There were 24 bombs fired by the hedgehog. They hit the water in a circle, or meant to, and they were, each one could be lifted by one person, although it was jolly difficult in a rough sea to do it. They had to be lifted and put on a spigot, each one of them. And as you stood over this darn thing with a ship railing and a huge weight in your arms trying to upend it over the spigot, you were terribly conscious if you fell down, you'd be sitting on a spike. And that was very uncomfortable indeed. So some skill was needed, and every now and then people got hurt doing this at sea. But it was something that had to be practiced, because reloading was an important feature, of course. The hell weapon system was, of course, not just the explosives. You mentioned the explosive thing, both in the gun bit, and we've gone on to control. In the anti-submarine bit, it was the detection device, which was absolutely crucial, because the ASDIC detected the submarines, and by plotting the command, the bridge, and the plot, was able to plot which direction the submarine was going in, or whether it was stopped, and therefore you were detecting a bubble and not a submarine at all, or a wreck or something. And you had to listen very carefully to the noise of the echo returning to see whether there was pitch discrimination between the transmitted noise and the echo. And you could tell whether there was some movement. But of course the movement might have been your movement over the seabed, and caused by tide. So there were certain calculations to be made, and it was very much a teamwork thing.
You had specialist ASDIC ratings. Did you understand much about ASDIC in yourselves?
Yes. I'd been to sea working up to learn how to do this. I'd had to pass courses in anti-submarine warfare, and I'd actually, in Tata, of course, worked with this as well. I was the gunnery officer, so when I was the officer of the watch, I was also responsible for dealing with ASDIC contacts. Particularly in Western Approaches, before going to Byron, I went to a millionaire's yacht called Philanthe. And Philanthe had been fitted with ASDICs and some ancient submarines, which could no longer be used to fight Germans, were sent out as clockwork mice. And we learned what it sounded like and what the submarines were doing, and we practiced endlessly with these things. And we told them when we were firing by dropping a Mills bomb or something in the water, and they fired a white smoke float, and then we could see how close we would have been if only. And we also went off and looked at rocks, and we looked at wrecks, and we dealt with currents. And it was an art form, actually, using the ASDIC at that stage. It's now much more scientific.
Could you actually use the machine yourself, or would you use the machine plus the ASDIC operator? Did you see what I mean?
If necessary, I was capable of using the device myself. The way it was controlled was down in the bottom of the ship. There was a dome which could be raised and lowered. If it was raised, then it smoothed off the bottom of the hull and you couldn't make any transmissions of the ASDIC at all. If it was lowered, it was down about 4 or 5 feet below the hull. And within that, there was a spindle and a circle of about a foot's diameter, just over a foot's diameter, where the piezoelectric crystals were persuaded to vibrate by giving them a kick with the electrical urge, was the way it worked. And that transmitted the sound out, and then you listen carefully for the noise to come back. It also showed on a trace in the Aztec room, which was always just in the front end of the bridge, and just below